Much has been said in the business world about shortages of skilled workers and the importance of retaining the best talent in today's highly competitive world markets. However, a confidential survey of senior-level managers at major corporations finds executives saying their companies are far too tolerant of average performers in key positions. According to McKinsey & Company, the consulting firm that conducted the study, only 3% of senior managers say their company routinely removes low performers. Only 16% say their company even recognizes the difference between high and low performers. Helen Hanfield-Jones is a consultant at McKinsey & Company in Toronto, and she joins us from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Company. Larry Pruzak is executive director of the IBM Institute for Knowledge Management. He joins us from member station WGBH in Boston. Hanfield-Jones says the new research shows that companies need to be more aggressive in weeding out that bottom 10 to 20% of its senior management ranks.
The reason we say that is there's an enormous impact that those leaders have on the rest of the organization. And if the organization is going to attract, excite, develop, and retain A-quality talent and B-quality performers, you can't do that effectively if you have a lot of what we would call C-players in leadership positions. Let me tell you about a very recent experience I've had in an organization that I've been working with where the head of a division has been thinking about moving more aggressively on A and C players and asked me to go and interview about 12 of his senior managers, which I did. And they all said to me, this place needs it. Without good assessment and action, you know, we are a political place where relationships matter more than performance. And it's just demotivating for me to see low performers continue to move up the ranks of the organization.
Larry Pruzak, what does it do to morale when employers start saying they're going to be more aggressive about weeding out low performers? Does that motivate people to work harder, or does it fill the air with the aroma of paranoia?
Well, I think the latter for sure. I work with a lot of large firms myself. We just don't see it that often. We see the lower rungs get released for economic reasons, but the compensation systems, the rewards to rank are skewed very much towards the top, and I just don't see this weeding. There's a tremendous lack of trust amongst large organizations for the workers, for the people who run the firm. And they themselves, as Helen just pointed out, often don't weed out low performers among the high-paid executives. So then people on the lower rungs in terms of status or pay say, well, gee, these people who don't perform very well hang on forever while you're very quick to get rid of us a little lower down the chain. So yeah, I think it does affect morale terribly. Eventually, those firms have a lot of trouble retaining and recruiting people they need.
Do you agree that companies can truly identify the high performers and the low performers and make these decisions in a fairly objective way?
I think at the higher rungs, it's management by the numbers. Did your unit, did your division make its performance goals, which 95% of the time are sales or market share goals? And I think that's also a very, very narrow way to look at performance. What's often in the business schools called the soft side, is this person really a leader? Is this person, do they really care about the people working for them? Do they look at all sorts of sides of an issue? Is this a pleasant place to work? Is the culture one of collaboration? It's very rarely monitored. It's very rarely measured. It's very rarely noticed.
Helen Hanfield-Jones?
I would say that what Larry has described is common practice and poor practice, not best practice. And companies should aspire for more than that. Yes, they must look at business results because that does say something about the individual's leadership. But they also look at a set of qualitative competencies and values, things like teamwork, strategic thinking, people leadership, and so on. And those qualitative assessments about the individual's leadership talent are very important. And we believe that good assessment needs to look at both the results and the leadership characteristics. Good assessment takes time. It takes effort. One of the fundamental principles that we recommend is that companies make sure that multiple senior people's viewpoints are brought to bear when assessing any one manager, that you don't leave it up just to the boss, and that it requires very good, candid discussion around a set of objective criteria. To not do that, in my mind, is somewhat of an abdication of a leader's responsibility in the way they manage their talent pool.
Money. Neither one of you have said a lot about that, but doesn't paying top dollar, isn't that still highly related to attracting and keeping top talent?
Well, it is somewhat. I think I actually believe in a positive note that it's less than it used to be. About 2 miles from where I'm sitting are two great small pharmaceutical firms, which are in the middle of a great war for talent. These firms are constantly looking for PhD biochemists and molecular biologists, et cetera. And they sometimes pay, in fact, often the pay rate they pay is less than the Mercks, the Pfizers, the Smith Kleins, and the Glaxos. But the opportunity to work there, the cultural milieu of these firms is so pleasant. They're so aggressive and intellectually aggressive. They're so open. They're still small. They're not bureaucratic. That people work there, and I've been there, I know this is the case, sometimes for $20,000, $30,000, or $50,000 less per year for the opportunity to work in that environment versus working in some very large bureaucratic type of organization.
Helen Hanfield-Jones, pay and benefits determinative in attracting and keeping talent?
They're important, but they're not the most important by any means. If the money that you offer a person is significantly below what their other options are looking at, it's very hard to get a look in. You have to be in the ballpark and be comparable financially. And then those other intrinsic and non-financial factors become the deciding factors in the situation.
Let me ask both of you to just sum up quickly the main mistake you think employers are making today in the war for talent.
I would say two things. One is assuming talent is the same thing as making your numbers. In other words, ignoring those aspects of talent that have to do with social skills, with leadership skills, with communication skills, all those collaborative stuff that's often labeled soft stuff, which it turns out to be the hard stuff. Ignoring that and say, did he or she make the numbers? I'd say that's the single largest failure. It leads to a certain types of organizations that people don't necessarily want to work for.
Hanfield-Jones, the main mistake?
The main mistake is that organizations do not hold their line leaders accountable for the quality of the talent pool they build. Talent management must be a central part of every leader's job, and most companies it's not. It's a skill and an expectation that line leaders are beginning to learn, and we see line leaders learning this, and we very much believe that 10 years from now we'll look back and say, wow, how can we ever have run these organizations without having made talent building a central part of a leader's responsibility?
Helen Hanfield-Jones is a senior consultant with McKinsey & Company in Toronto. Larry Pruzak is executive director of the IBM Institute for Knowledge Management in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They'll be continuing their discussion on the talent wars and upcoming issues of the Harvard Business Review. Thank you both for talking with us.
Thank you, David.
David.